tune out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 3rd of September, 2026, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's Thursday once again, which means it's Geopolitical Analysis Day here at Radio Albion, and we have the finest geopolitical analyst with us today, Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from RussJournal.org. Matt, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Well, I have a few things on my mind that everyone has to hear about. First of all, we're coming up on the 25th anniversary of 9/11. And as the man who wrote the very first 9/11 truth article, that very day, in fact, in Washington, D.C., no less, this is going to be my final statement. I'm so sick of it. It's going to be like, I already got like 50 pages worth of stuff. And we'll talk about that at some point on the show when we, you know, I think it's the day before. I think it's a Friday this year. That's the first thing. The second thing, and it's really been bugging me recently, Led Zeppelin, I love one song by them, and it was Out on the Tiles. They never played it live. Never. It's impossible to get a live version of it. And that's really been driving me crazy recently. So that's how I'm doing, basically. Those are the two things on my mind. And not just working on this huge 9/11 thing, but I have like four books going at the same time. So I'm just, I'm a little frazzled. But the Zeppelin thing really drives me crazy. I don't know why they didn't play it live. It drives me nuts.
I really can't help you with that one because I'm not sure of what actual track it is. I don't think that I've heard of it before. And you must be feeling pretty frazzled after having four books on the back burner. And I think doing a 9/11 would be an excellent choice for an episode of the Daily Nationalist. We've probably got lots of listeners that might not even remember that when that happened. It was so long ago. I certainly wasn't a nationalist back then, and there was a lot of stuff about it up until about 2011, 2012. I mean, the internet was still full of it, but you don't tend to see so much of it now. But we're going to be talking about a different subject to that today. We're going to be talking about Venezuela, the kidnapping of Maduro, and specifically the theft of Venezuelan oil. And we're going to be using globalresearch.net for our source material. On August 29th, President Trump went on social media and boasted about stealing Venezuelan oil. The theft, according to Trump, more than doubles American oil reserves. He said there was no cost to American taxpayers, although there will obviously be a huge cost to the people of Venezuela, who will see little, if any, benefit from Trump's plunder. He went so far as to claim the brazen theft will benefit the Venezuelan people. The profits are expected to enrich oil company executives and elites rather than ordinary citizens. The average monthly net salary in Venezuela is $218. Poverty is extremely severe, with over 80% of households affected and more than half living in extreme poverty. A significant portion of the population faces food shortages, with many unable to afford basic food items. The United States sold much of the pilfered oil to Vitol, a Geneva-based energy and commodity trading firm, and also Trafigura, a Singapore-based multinational commodities company. The theft and sale of oil has raised concerns about transparency and accountability, especially regarding the management and distribution of its proceeds. 8 months after Trump snatched, quote, millions of barrels, close quote, of oil, the administration floated a lie to cover its audacious theft. The State Department proclaimed that it would use profits from the sales for the benefit of the American people and the Venezuelan people. It later said that billions of dollars have been dispersed to the Venezuelan economy and that financial monitoring is underway to ensure funds benefit the Venezuelan people. The Financial Times reported there is no evidence of oil money returning to Venezuela as claimed by Trump, and that Venezuela's GDP in the first quarter was its lowest in 5 years. Oil makes up virtually a quarter of the country's GDP. Now, I look at that and, okay, I mean, there's two ways this could be. They've said it's been dispersed to the Venezuelan economy. It's gone to the Venezuelan people. I mean, it might very well have gone to debts to American companies, and they may have paid off some debt that they might have said that Venezuela owed the oil companies for using the infrastructure, basically, that was set up by these American oil companies. So, I mean, that may have happened. And then Trump wouldn't be lying by saying it was to the benefit of the Venezuelan people, because it would have been paying the Venezuelan people's debts. So I'm not so certain we can say that it has definitely been stolen, because, it, as I say, I mean, it could have gone on these debts. What do you think of that, Matt? Is that possible?
Every time we talk about Trump and foreign policy, it gets worse. And when you think you can't get any lower, you know, he goes lower. And, you know, paying debts. Well, these are the debts either of the state or of corporations that have been privatized over the last few years. You know, we've been talking about Venezuela for God knows. I think since Chavez was in power, been talking about him for a very long time. The left likes to consider him a socialist, but we know he was a national socialist. In his reign, you know, poverty was slashed in half. Extreme poverty went down to 7%. American sanctions and warfare completely destroyed this. Land reform, you know, millions of peasants got land for the first time. It was becoming self-sufficient in food. And, you know, that amount I wrote on the original here compared to what, that would have been sufficient under Chavez, because there were so many subsidies and the economy still was continuing to grow. You had tremendous optimism there. Today, I think the exchange rate is one American dollar for 200 billion Venezuelan. I think it's Venezuelan peso, something ridiculous like that. So $218 is meaningless either way, but that would have been sufficient to lead a normal life under Chavez back then, and even the early Maduro, gallon of gas, something like, you know, 5 cents. So much was subsidized. Everything was subsidized, and the economy continued to grow. Now, as far as, you know, benefiting the typical Venezuelan, there's nothing like that. He said it in such a way where he means that he's going to be plowed into investment for the population. Paying debts, that means this goes to American corporations. I don't even know if the state debt is even repayable thanks to sanctions. You know, sanctions actually can work in a Latin American country because they're so close to the U.S. and so dependent on the U.S. You know, Chavez and early Maduro, they were going to break that dependency. And Maduro was making great strides. And when sanctions were placed on it, it started in the Obama administration, and constant threats of invasion, the economy fell apart. And you have these stupid Republicans in this country going on about how awful socialism is. So look how awful Venezuela is. Not telling them at all about how the economy was deliberately strangled, and that it was doing extremely well under the national socialism of Hugo Chavez, who was a military man, who was extremely popular, and the U.S. had financed his opposition. We talked about this many times. I talked about it when you were in the can. And, you know, it's so outrageous what the U.S. has done down there. And, of course, one of the first things that this new so-called president did upon taking over is restoring relations with Israel. And we're going to learn, I think, in the next article, that a lot of this oil is going to the Israelis because of the damage that the Iranians have done. So it's just one outrage after another. And the Israelis have a lot to do with this as well, at least for that reason alone. Everything's been privatized and taken over by Western corporations, and the dire poverty, 80%, it was nothing like that under Chavez. It was low. It was collapsing under Chavez, that poverty number. And well, we can't have that. So they destroyed the country and then blamed Maduro for it.
Well, if they can get by on $200 a month and the oil that is their oil, I mean, it should be sold at the same price that all oil is sold at, around about $100 a barrel, I think it could be at the moment. So, I mean, it's high prices. So even if there was just a small increase on that $200 a month, I mean, it would make a big difference to them, wouldn't it? And you would think that if the oil can now be sold, that they would be better off and that it wouldn't just go on debts. And I say, I'm only suggesting that as that is where the money could have gone. I mean, we can't specifically say that Trump has stolen it. We just haven't been told where these profits have actually gone, and they could have gone to paying debts. That's,
it used to be plowed straight into infrastructure and land reform, like Gaddafi or Assad. And the economy exploded because of that. And with a great degree of equality. I mean, there's always inequality, obviously, but nothing like it is now. The opposition parties, almost every one financed by USAID and companies like this. And to think that this is no cost to the American taxpayer is ridiculous because, they've been financing. God knows how much it costs to send the task force down there. They had to pay off the Venezuelan military to not do anything because they could have intervened. It would have been impossible. The head of the military is a guy named, strange name, Vladimir Lopez, who did sign off on the American operation and I'm sure was very well paid as a result. So they were armed to the teeth with all of this, with the assistance of Russia and China. But Trump's making it sound like this oil money is going to, rebuilding infrastructure and things like that. No, if it's going to debt at all, it's going to the debt of these newly privatized firms that now do business abroad and have driven the population into dire poverty that it had never known prior to or during the Chavez era and afterwards.
Yeah, so I mean, there is a plausible deniability, I guess you could say, that we don't really know where this is. So I'm a bit loath to just assume that it's been stolen. As you say, Matt, I mean, it could have gone to some of these other companies, but we should be told. I mean, they should be transparent. They should be saying what's happening with this money. Well, the Swiss company Vitol is involved in shipping Venezuelan oil to Israel, which is used in part to fuel its ongoing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza and attacks on Shiite communities in southern Lebanon. Vitol's Saras refinery in Sarok, Sardinia, Italy, provided 17% of Israel's imports of oil and refined products. In February, it was reported the first shipment of stolen oil went to Israel. The shipment was not the result of a decision made by Venezuela or its Petróleos de Venezuela, the PDVSA, but rather as an indirect consequence of the reconfiguration of the global energy market orchestrated by Washington, writes Mission Verdad for the Orinoco Tribune. On February 10th, Bloomberg Linea, a Spanish and Portuguese language news website, reported the oil cargo was transported to the Bazan Group, an oil refining and petrochemicals company located in Haifa Bay, Israel. It is the largest refinery in the country, although it has been severely damaged by Iran. The Zionist government does not announce where it obtains crude oil. According to Bloomberg Linea, tankers heading to the port often disappear from tracking systems as they approach Israel. The Israel Ministry of Energy declined to reveal where the country gets its oil. Why do the Israelis not want to know people to know where they are getting their oil from? I mean, does it really matter where they're getting their oil from? Could there be an embargo put on this oil to prevent it getting there? I doubt it. I mean, what do you think the reason is why these Israelis don't want people to know where they get their oil from, Matt?
The fact that they, drop off the radar, so to speak, from the tracking systems, that's a sophisticated operation. if they have to go past any, you know, Yemeni outpost, if they have to go up through there, they're going to be hit immediately. And I think they're trying to sneak in. There's a couple of problems with this that kind of bother me. First of all, Bloomberg, you know, has nothing to do with, you know, it's a Spanish version of the Bloomberg, you know, in the U.S. The oil company has been privatized and been bought up by some of these investors. Beyond that, Venezuelan oil tends to be of low quality, heavily loaded with sulfites and many other impurities. There's a few American refineries that know how to deal with that. I've not come across anyone else who knows how to deal with that. It's conceivable that there's maybe one or two in Europe. I've not come across it before. It takes a very specialized refining system because it is one of their lowest quality on the planet. And it's very difficult and expensive to refine it. Now, I know for a fact that so many of these ports have been annihilated by the Iranian. It's come up in, you know, I've dealt with it before with you and in other places in writing and elsewhere, that so much of that infrastructure in the north of Israel has been completely destroyed or damaged beyond belief. So where it actually is and what they can do with it and who can actually refine it, I don't know. And so there's, you know, this sounds more like a propaganda thing than anything else. It's conceivable that the person who is writing this wants to alert the Yemenis and others who are capable of hitting them of these oil shipments. Certainly the Iranians have every right to sink these ships, which is why they're going kind of going dark as they get close to the area. If there's any ship that they're going to sink, it's going to be something like that. And the Yemeni military has made that very, very clear. So I have the feeling that there's a lot of trickery in how it gets there. But I haven't looked into it in very much depth as to who else but the Americans, especially in a couple of places in Louisiana, can deal with Venezuelan oil. Certainly the Israelis cannot, but maybe it can be dealt with in Sardinia. Chances are it is probably that it is an American firm, or at least heavily invested in by the U.S., not just Italy or Sardinians. Most of these are. And, of course, there is no market. You know, a handful of companies set the price. Yeah, there isn't, calling it a market is you know, it makes me smile. So there's a lot of problems with this. And media, you know, are told what they say, told what they are supposed to say, and they just say it. And I'm not sure if there's much left in that part of, especially Haifa and elsewhere, that they could even receive this oil at this point, because the Iranians have pounded it into, you know, and I don't think the money is there presently to rebuild it, unlike Iran, which is already being rebuilt. And that's why the Ministry of Energy is kind of, you know, they went dark about this, and the Ministry of Energy has declined to say much about it. They can't alert anybody as to where these ships are and where they're coming from, or else they're going to be gone. They're going to be destroyed.
Well, that's a good reason for hiding them from the radar. But, I mean, you're saying there about Iran hitting these Israeli targets, I mean, they seem to be covering that up. We don't hear anything about anywhere that Iran has hit for months now in this war that's going on. So you know that it must be going on. You know, they must be hitting places in Israel, but we're just not being told about it. You know, we got told recently, I think Trump hit Karg Island, and then he made up an AI video pretending to hit Karg Island. And I mean, there must be retaliation, but we don't hear about it, Matt. I mean, do you hear about it on the news over there at all?
No.
Any attacks by Iran on Israel?
No, I have to go to Russian sources for that, Belarusian sources for that, prior to sometimes even Turkish, although I certainly can't read the language. Russian sources report on this all the time. But remember, there's a very strict censorship law not just in Israel, but all the Gulf states, where they cannot report on this. They cannot have pictures or video. There's a whole bunch of people in prison right now. Saudi Arabia also. If they talk about where these missiles have gone and what's destroyed and what isn't, the Russian press will tell you all about it. The Iranian press will tell you all about it. Some in Central Asia, you know. So there's other places you have to go to get this information, but certainly not from the U.S. and certainly not from the even more censored press in the EU and European countries in general.
Yeah, it's certainly being kept away from us. I don't hear anything on GB News about attacks on Israel. Do hear about America attacking Iran, but not vice versa. Delcy Rodriguez, who became president after Trump abducted President Maduro on bogus drug charges, restored relations with Israel in August. In 2009, Venezuela, along with Bolivia, severed ties with Israel in response to its occupation in Gaza and its ongoing violence against the Palestinian people. The Trump administration is busy at work promoting and helping install pro-American rulers in Latin America. And we talked about this, didn't we, Matt? We did, when we had a look at the security plans, international security, and there was going to be this American sphere of influence, which was going to be Latin America. Of course, he didn't say anything about attacking Iran, but he did say that they wanted to have American-friendly regimes throughout South America. So, I mean, this was sort of foreshadowed basically by this security document that we went through. Well, the abduction of Maduro is the signature event of Trump's Monroe corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. The Monroe Doctrine, first articulated by President James Monroe on December 2nd, 1823, warned European powers not to attempt colonization in Latin America. The Roosevelt corollary, pronounced by President Theodore Roosevelt in 1904, expanded the original Monroe Doctrine by asserting that the United States could intervene in the internal affairs of Latin American countries in order to protect American business interests and investments. Trump expanded the Roosevelt corollary and insisted Venezuela return land, oil, and other assets he claimed it stole from the United States. And it says here the Roosevelt corollary was repudiated by the Clark Memorandum under President Coolidge. Now, I'm not sure whether that's in the article here or whether you've added that. Matt, do you know anything about that? Was it repudiated? Well, because, I mean, what's going on
yeah,
there?
Yeah, anything in brackets is me. And, you know, the ridiculously named Monroe corollary has nothing to do with the Monroe Doctrine whatsoever. That was simply that the U.S. is going to respond if there's any, especially Spanish attempts to, or French attempts to colonize any country in Latin America. And that was the end of it. Now, the Roosevelt corollary, which is Theodore, of course, again, also had nothing to do with the Roosevelt Doctrine and completely perverted it. Trump says we could do whatever we want here. Now, the Clark Memorandum was a completely different story. The Clark Memorandum tried to repudiate the Roosevelt corollary by simply saying, we know what President Monroe meant, and it was simply to protect recently, back then in the 19th century, recently independent Latin American states from being recolonized. So it was a threat against Europe, especially Spanish-speaking Europe, not has nothing to do with the internal issues in these countries. And so Coolidge was, you know, American firster in that regard. And now, of course, the Clark Memorandum has been totally overthrown. And I guess people are dumb enough not to really know what the Monroe Doctrine is. But that is long been history, because Trump now says essentially Latin America is the property of the United States. And when we say pro-American regimes, what we mean is a liberal society. A weak government, on what we used to call banana republics, that can very easily be penetrated by American capital, dominated by American capital. Essentially, you know, the IMF, you know, taking it over and privatizing everything, which means that the U.S. would end up buying a big chunk of it and running it for their own benefit. That's what pro-American means. There's a myth out there, and I have a book on the true record of the Latin American military dictators, 70s and 80s, et cetera, And they were not supported by the U.S. They were rejected by the U.S. That's an old myth that the left promoted. The U.S. rejected them because they were simply too unpredictable. They were from the peasant classes. They nationalized, they even, you know, Pinochet nationalized the copper industry, the number one industry of Chile. No one talks about that. Military governments are tend to be populist and nationalist, even national socialist, just like Chavez, and not anything that the U.S. wanted to deal with, as the CIA documents in that era say, and as my book goes through all of them. They're very easy to read. So that's what pro-American means. Pro-American means weak, so that American corporations can tell them what to do and get them into debt and really be anything but representative of the average Catholic person in places like Bolivia and Ecuador.
You know, strange how America can see that the lands close to it, it should be a part of the American sphere of influence, but it doesn't seem to quite understand that the lands right next to Russia should be the Russian sphere of influence, like Ukraine, or that should be a buffer zone between Russia and Europe. I mean, it accepts that Latin America is right next to it, so it's its sphere of influence, but Ukraine is right next to Russia, and Russia is not allowed to have that as its sphere of influence. Well, Trump's statement was absurd because Venezuela has never stolen anything from the United States, while his threat of using force violated UNSC Resolution 2.4, which prevents members from threatening to use force against others, notes Simon Shege Nidaritu, writing for New Eastern Outlook. However, the UN's mix of silence and chamfered response to US aggression against Venezuela constitutes approval of modern colonialism, Nidaritu stated. And the term chamfered refers to the elimination of dangerous 90-degree corners to make handling safer. And you say you're not sure the term is appropriate here. Donald Trump's theft of a vital natural resource from an impoverished country on the heels of a military operation should not be unexpected. President Trump and his family have exploited their position to profit through cryptocurrency and related ventures. I would like to know more about that as far as cryptocurrency is concerned. Bitcoin does appear to be increasing in value again, or at least it was a couple of weeks back. And I'm not sure about any legislation that's coming in. I'd like to know more about how Trump is exploiting his position to profit through cryptocurrency and related ventures. According to a congressional committee estimate, as of January 2026, these schemes generated approximately $2.25 billion in realized profits from foreign payments and elsewhere. Additionally, there has been unusual trading activity that frequently spikes just before Trump makes a significant public statement. This pattern was also evident before Trump announced a pause on tariffs, where traders were betting on stock market increases right before the announcement. Well, I don't think that's any different to any other administration in America. I mean, there's all this profiting from insider trading. There's always been allegations about it. I don't think it's just Trump that's responsible for that. When the Trump administration kidnapped the President Maduro and his wife on January 3rd, an open incitement to international law breaking was asserted. Here was thuggish impunity, crude acquisition, and harsh plunder in operation. That is the seizure of a sovereign leader in office on fanciful narco-terrorist charges, a violation of the territorial sanctity of a state guaranteed by Article 2 of the UN Charter, and the demand that Venezuela be compliant with Washington's objectives in its vulgar reiteration of the Monroe Doctrine. The prize was clearly oil. And we've pointed out before that these charges, the majority of them were dropped, weren't they, Matt? After they'd got him, after they arrested him, got him on American soil, and then they dropped a large number of these charges. You know, the very reason why they supposedly had to go in there and get him. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I remember talking to you about this. The Venezuelan state has very little to do with international drug trade. In fact, both Chavez and Maduro were at war with it. There were no cartels there. They don't grow coca leaves there. But the worst one was the Cartel of the Sun, which is supposed to be a government and military cartel that funneled drugs into the U.S. We said, and I knew that it didn't exist. There was no such entity. It was kind of a mashup of some television shows. And they finally now admitted and dropped that there was no such entity. But all the media said it was. Everyone but us. And there were a few other cartels. I mean, it wouldn't make any sense to use Venezuela. No one's going through the Caribbean anymore. That lane has been shut for a long time. Even in the 80s, it was shut. They're going elsewhere. They're going upwards and land and up and through the Pacific as well. So there was never narco-terrorism at all in Venezuela. It's the same thing in Afghanistan. You know, the Taliban destroyed the drug trade there. But in a kind of very twisted projection, the U.S. claimed that the Taliban were involved in the drug trade, which, you know, there was a fatwa killing anybody who was involved. They won their drug war. Venezuela had done very well, but they were never really a part of it in the first place. It's a tiny amount, if anything. It comes through Peru and, of course, Colombia. Venezuela is simply not involved. So the judge is a Zionist Jew, 92 years old, I think. And so he had nothing to do with Grammy, but the prosecution says, you know, we don't have any evidence of this stuff. We're pretty safe to say we're never going to see Maduro ever again. Not a whole lot of news on it. They're not going to let him go. Oh, we were wrong. That would be humiliation, and they would never do it. The other thing that irritates me here is this: who gives a damn whether the UN charter is violated? The UN doesn't have an army; they can't enforce any of this. Who cares about international law? You know, these papers talk about international law like it matters. You know, when I was in grad school, I had to take class after class on this stuff, and it's sheer rhetoric. No one could even tell you what's in these documents. Only specialists would really know. No one voted on this stuff. International law came out of World War II, and it's never and it can't be enforced. So if that's going to be the argument, it's a stupid argument because no one really cares. It's a rhetorical way of condemning somebody with nothing else. And oil was definitely the prize, destroying the possibility of national socialism in Latin America was another, creating an economy separate from the U.S. Like Chavez, the Bank of the South, he was creating very similar to a bank that was Gaddafi was creating in Libya, and destroying the economic growth that came from a non-liberal system, which humiliated the U.S. So, and you're right, of course, about the people profiting on this stuff. The only difference here is tariffs weren't really a big issue. Tariffs, and I have no problem with them. The tariffs have brought other countries to the negotiating table. The Chinese really haven't. They don't need the U.S. market like they used to. And has been a somewhat successful weapon. I have no problem with import substitution and all that. If another country charged tariffs, then they're going to be attacked. But the U.S. can do it. And it's been kind of erratic, but it's been on a case-by-case basis. And whether you sell a stock short, you know, which you can make money on a falling stock, you know how that works, or a rising stock using some other method, it doesn't matter. These people can make money on anything. And the stock market really has nothing to do with how well the American economy is doing. Often they're inversely related. That value in any stock comes from the labor of the people who work there. And it rises and falls, not because the company is doing well, but because there's, you know, rumors about it. There's demand for the stock from the that have been created by the press or something like that, have nothing to do with anything value, having to do with value. And if it gets too high, then you're going to have the bubble's going to burst, and the only people who are really going to pay for it are the people who work there. Just like the American bubble bursting in 2008, which the U.S. has never recovered from. Huge unemployment spikes and bankruptcy spikes. So I think tariffs are really the only thing that makes Donald Trump different in that regard. And, you know, big companies, especially on Wall Street and companies, they know, they have people on Capitol Hill. They pretty much have an idea what's going on. I don't know if it counts as insider trading. It's sort of insider trading, I guess. in a way. But these things are talked about before they actually get signed. Tariffs are an executive branch prerogative. Essentially almost a form of a sanction, really. And so, and it has brought countries to the table. But again, the U.S. could never repay its debt, you know, and it keeps going up. Now, cryptocurrency has done very well. When Trump was first elected, cryptocurrency went through the roof. It went through the roof for a long time. El Salvador, under Bukele, declared cryptocurrency as one of the official currencies of the country. Now that has calmed down over the last year. It's been pretty erratic. And some people are really taking a bath on it, but you really can't bet on it too much. What his family is doing relative to cryptocurrency, I simply don't know off the top of my head.
Yeah, I'd like to know what the author is specifically referring to. I mean, Bitcoin, it went up to $100,000 or over £100,000, something like that, and then it dropped to $60,000. And then I think it's gone up again by 5 or 10 over the last week. But ever since last November, it's been sort of half what it was before. There's been quite a concern about it. And I'd like to know why it's suddenly increased in value now, what that is related to. It's certainly quite a volatile stock, basically, to have. Towards the end of August, President Donald Trump was in a sprightly mood on his favorite platform of choice, Truth Social. In a post, the president announced that he had reached with Venezuela, quote, the biggest oil deal in world history, exclamation mark, capitals, close quote. Under his direction, the U.S. Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, the Secretary of War, Pete Cut the Track Hegseth, working with what does that mean? I don't get that joke. Explain that one to me. Explain that one to me, Matt. I'm a little bit simple here.
You have to watch Saturday Night Live. They do a version of Pete Hegseth, which is hilarious. That's exactly how I picture him. And he has his own theme music when he comes on, like a wrestler. And he yells, cut the track, cut it. And then he starts talking like he's a frat boy. And that's exactly. And anytime I write Pete Hegseth, cut the track, it's always in the middle. That's just, we have to deal with it.
Right. Okay. Pete Cut the Track Hegseth, working with President in quotation marks Rodriguez of Venezuela, in partnership with private business, have secured majority U.S. control of more than 65 billion barrels of proven oil reserves in Venezuela, at no cost to the American taxpayer. This brazen assertion of control would more than double oil reserves in the United States, currently at 46 billion barrels, increase oil supply, and most importantly, regarding the election prospects for the Republicans, substantially lower gas prices for all Americans long into the future, while helping to continue to set Venezuela on a course to tremendous success and great prosperity. Lasting 25 years, the agreement was in line with the country's hydrocarbons law and would secure $100 billion in investment, with $209.3 billion in royalties and taxes. The new president was less than forthcoming about the level of tax revenue that will flow in from these transactions. This initiative is, as with much issuing from the mind and easy mouth of Trump, one part hope and several parts fiction. The initial question to ask is when the benefits of this plunderous exercise will flow back to the American economy in any timely way. Ultimately, prices are going to come down, Trump remarked in the Oval Office. Now, will it happen before the election? I can't tell you that. The cognoscenti in the field of commodities are both sceptical and excited. Patrick DeHaan, head of petroleum analysis at Gas Buddy, the app that finds the cheapest gas stations in any city, offered his doubts to The Hill. It might be that prices would come down several years from now, but that was hardly likely in the short term. There were, for instance, troubling legal risks to the agreement and various other contingencies, but were it to have legs with huge investments with a big increase in oil production, it could be big. But again, the gas price impacts are years down the road, not days, weeks, or months. Now, looking at that, I mean, basically he's saying that he's got all of this at no cost to America. Is he basically saying we are going to have access to this oil, or is he saying we're just going to acquire all this oil and we're not going to have to pay anything for it? I'm a little bit confused there, Matt. Can you enlighten me, please?
Well, it's simply not going to be free. I mean, someone has to profit for this. Donald Trump says that that oil is ours. He said it before. You have a dependent class of wealthy people in Venezuela who get a nice cut of this. And, you know, I use president in quotes in front of Delcy Rodriguez because she really is an idiot. I don't just say that because I don't like her. She really is. She failed out of every law school. They still call her a lawyer somehow. She tried to go to get educated abroad. She failed out of the law school, one of the law schools in Paris. I don't even know if she speaks French. They still call her a lawyer though in Venezuela. When she was installed as Vice President Maduro, you know, she was the oligarchic candidate. Maduro made a huge mistake bringing her up. It really was more affirmative action. She's too ugly for him to be doing her. So it has to just be, you know, she has tremendous ties with the oligarchy there, an oligarchy that didn't exist under Chavez. So Maduro started to weaken at some point. Bringing Rodriguez there, I mean, she was, even when Maduro was firmly in power, she was going to conferences of the oligarchs. I've written this elsewhere, and I've talked about it elsewhere, of, you know, various conferences of these oligarchs. And when Maduro was kidnapped, the first thing that she said when she became president was that we're going to do whatever the U.S. wants. And, of course, one of the very first things she did, as we said, is recognize Israel and assist them financially with oil shipments, I guess. I think. I doubt it, but that's what they're saying here. But Donald Trump, he has this very odd way of writing. He's the opposite of a statesman. All caps sometimes, like he's yelling at us, and he capitalizes things like oil reserves are capitalized. I don't get it. But to answer your question, it's a little bit of both. Now, keep in mind, there is no such thing as a gas market oil market doesn't exist. The minute the war started with Iran, gasoline prices, that is refined oil, went through the roof. Now, that's impossible if there was actually a market. The oil was simply an excuse for the handful of firms that refine and sell gasoline in the retail to increase the price. There's no way it could have affected America that quickly. Actually, it wouldn't affect America at all. The U.S. doesn't get any oil from that part of the world. God, the oil firms were increasing gas prices when the Ukraine war broke out. Any excuse that they could think of. And it just proved that this is all set. Now that Trump is saying we have far more oil now than before, gas prices going down? No. Again, more evidence that this is set. So it goes up immediately when the Iran war breaks out, which is, you know, if it was a real market, it would be impossible. There was a glut at the time anyway. And it would take a very long time going through literally the pipeline before it would affect the U.S. And it would not affect the U.S. at all. That would affect Europe, maybe. It might affect parts of India. But it certainly wouldn't affect the U.S. So it's just an excuse. But now that there's more oil available. And remember what Putin said. He said, listen, why don't you just lift sanctions? The Russians will take care of you. And Trump was very taken by that for a while. And then it was dropped. I don't know whatever came of it. No one's talking about it anymore. No one is. So, you know, I simply don't believe anything the guy says, especially when he starts using capital letters and he's yelling at you. To think that there's no cost to the American taxpayer, of course, there's been a tremendous cost. Just in the operation itself. But Donald Trump simply can't take the oil. You know, he has to deal with oligarchs both on the ground as well as the American firms who are going to be, you know, doing the work of extracting it. And they want a cut. They're going to be controlling it. Donald Trump doesn't have a whole lot of influence over it. they, you know, he acts as their bodyguard, you know, by destroying, you know, Maduro and all that. So while the U.S. has to pay for that operation, they're not going to benefit. Only the corporations that are involved in this are going to benefit financially, and they're not going to lower the prices. He may have to go to them and make a deal, like British Petroleum and you know Chevron, American oil company, you know, Amoco, or Sun Oil Company, Sunoco, Texas Oil Company, Texaco, and make a deal. You know, we'll cut taxes on you if you lower prices. That's the most he's going to be able to do with this. There is no market. Even if you go to Aramco in Saudi Arabia, it's supposed to be allegedly a state-owned enterprise. I've looked at each member of the board. Everyone has an Arabic name, of course. And you look at their biography. They're more American than they are Saudi or Arabic. They were all, every last one, educated, either, you know, Yale, New York University, Miami, Ohio State. You know, they're kind of Saudis. They're more Americans than they are anything else. So even there, even a state-owned Saudi firm is mostly American, despite the names of these people. So Trump has to deal with them. And the only power he really has over them is calling them up and promising them you know, lower taxes or something, less regulation. And then maybe the U.S. Might benefit from it. But otherwise, he's going to be controlled by the corporations that he's now empowered with all these privatizations, whether it be American companies, first of all, and then maybe a few MNCs, and of course the Israelis. The number one thing that happened, allegedly, although I don't know how they could handle it or how it can be refined over there, but we know for certain that now that it's all privatized, Maduro is gone, this idiot is now running things and saying she'll do whatever the U.S. says. Her brother's the same way. And it's now being controlled by these corporations that the U.S. government made possible. So the price is not coming down. Or if it's coming down, it'll be very slight and sporadic. But the market is an oligarchy. And oligarchies and markets are opposites. They're not the same thing. Oligarchy replaces markets. It doesn't respond to them. And that's the key issue.
So the price might come down a little bit at some point in the future. It's certainly not going to come down in time for the midterms, is it? Well, there are a multitude of considerations as to why the long run matters. From Lippo Oil Associates, Andy Lippo reminds us about the necessary infrastructure for the venture to work. It's going to take a decade to upgrade the infrastructure system to have a material impact on the oil market. Though he did not wish to ignore the possibility of some incremental improvements in the next year or two. To push Venezuelan oil to levels of high production could cost somewhere in the order of $180 billion. An extraordinary amount of money is needed to be spent just to get oil out of the ground and delivered to the market before it is even refined. The agreement has all the crude tailoring of gangster capitalism. The Trump administration is not exactly forthcoming on the list of enlisted business partners, but one reliably soiled candidate is North American Blue Energy Partners, NABEP, led by the Venezuelan investor Alejandro Betancourt. The company is planning to move 6 drilling rigs into its Venezuelan oil fields by the end of the year, with the intention of deploying a further 12 rigs in 2027. The anticipated total is 52. In keeping with Trump's taste for squalid, thieving characters, Betancourt is under investigation for overseeing the embezzling of $2 billion from state oil company Petróleos de Venezuela, the PDVSA, having also caught the eye of authorities in Spain and Switzerland for alleged money laundering and tax fraud. Despite this seemingly choking cloud of suspicion and query, Betancourt has been given near complete freedom to use private planes, accompanied by his troop of family, partners, investors and business associates from the banking and mining industries. And you've added there, this is because the evidence against him is weak and all previous investigations have led to nothing. As for the aforementioned legal risks, these are hard to shake off. Does the transaction pass muster under the Venezuelan constitution, given that Washington, not Caracas, is the one deciding the model at stake and companies that will participate in the venture? Trump has no care in the world for such statutory niceties, but prospective business partners and investors do. Luisa Palacios, an adjunct researcher at Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy, is blunt on this point. If the goal was to try to reduce the risk of investing in Venezuela, the United States might be doing the exact opposite with this transaction, further weakening the country's already fragile institutional framework. Well, what about if the illegal aspects to this? I mean, if he's putting people in charge of it that have all these allegations against them of fraud, and if it looks like, you know, there's theft has been involved as well, then, I mean, this transaction itself could be the result of legal action further down the line, which is obviously going to weaken the country. If you're going to do something like this, it has to be on a stable footing, I would have thought, rather than doing it like this. I mean, they could just be setting up problems for themselves ahead. Do you want to comment on that, Matt, and give us your final thoughts for the day?
I do. It's odd the people who the author is citing here, that Gas Buddy has a head of petroleum analysis. I can't imagine what they would need that for, given what they are. Lipa Oil Associates is fairly small. That may be relevant. And an adjunct analyst, too, is not anyone of, and they really don't say anything. Now, I don't like Alejandro Betancourt. No one likes oligarchs like this. But I've read quite a bit about him, and they're trying to drag him down. He must be wavering in his loyalties. But every time they try to get him in front of a judge, he wins. And when I say that, he must be, you know, it must be true. I mean, because I hate these guys. And they've tried to do this to him many times, and the evidence is always very weak. So they might just get rid of him. But he's just one of these guys who's involved. And, you know, these guys don't care really what Trump does, these private firms and the local oligarchs there, because they're the ones who are profiting. They're the ones who are doing the work. But I do like when they say that it's going to be a while before American rigs are in order and the proper facilities to refine this low-quality oil are in action. So he does say what I'm saying here. He doesn't say it in quite the same way, but this is what he means. Andy Lipow knows what he's talking about. It's going to be a while. $180 billion is maybe a low figure. So nothing's really going to change. But in the future, it will profit from a lot of people. They just bring in Betancourt because they think that you know, he's just under investigation yet again. And frankly, I don't think anyone cares what the Constitution of Venezuela says. Same way they don't care what international law says. And I also don't think that business partners give a damn what the Constitution says. You know, that would be the weakest argument imaginable. Oh, this is against the Constitution. They're going to roll their eyes because profit matters. Political control matters. The U.S. is now in control, at least of the state in Caracas. I don't know elsewhere, but the U.S. state is in control, and they've empowered both local oligarchs as well as American oligarchs to go in and take this oil. The profit is not going to come right away, which is something that no one else is talking about, which I'm happy that they quote this Andy Lipow. And it's in order what I've kind of said already, that it's going to be very difficult because Venezuelan oil is not something that the Americans or anyone else is really used to. So given the nature of it, given the sulfites and other impurities that are found in it, unless they have different methods, but different methods require more investment. And there's no doubt in my mind that Trump's going to subsidize some of this. So every time we cover Donald Trump and foreign policy, it just gets worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. The truth is Venezuela was a prosperous country under the national socialism of Chavez in the early years of Maduro. It was progressing tremendously and breaking poverty and literacy, land reform and everything else until the U.S. government decided that they're going to take all of this. And it's reached its zenith, its apogee, under the Trump administration, and they've completely destroyed the country as a result.
Well, it's a great shame, But again, it's something that really could have been predicted. I mean, Donald Trump has been talking about Maduro for quite a while. And then, of course, there was all that build up accusing him of narco terrorism. But it was quite an audacious plot to just go there and kidnap him. But it had been signaled that that was on the way, as I say, referring back to that national security document that we went through that said that America was going to have as its sphere of influence Latin America. And leaders of countries that were not pro-American had better watch out, effectively, is what it said. And this is the end results of it. Well, thank you very much, Matt, for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Grandpa Dan. God bless and hail victory.